Welcome to the Natural Healing Show. Keep it natural with the Natural Healing Show.
Hello, you are listening to the Natural Healing Show for UK Health Radio. I'm your host, Catherine Kerrigan, medical intuitive healer and Amazon number one best-selling author. You can find out more about me and my work at CatherineKerrigan.com and UnlimitedEnergyNow.com. While you're there, definitely sign up for my newsletter so you can learn even more about how you can heal yourself naturally. Our guest today is Patrick Hahn. Patrick Hahn is the author of three books, Madness and Genetic Determinism, Prescription for Sorrow, and the book that we're going to be talking about today, Obedience Pills, ADHD, and the Medicalization of Children. You can find out more about Patrick Hahn and his wonderful work at his website, Meliponula. I'll have you say that.
Okay. Meliponula.wordpress.com.
Thank you. And he is also an affiliate professor of biology at Loyola University in Maryland. Welcome, Patrick Hahn.
Thank you.
So, Patrick Hahn, what actually is ADHD?
Well, ADHD stands for Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder. This is a diagnostic category that came into being only in 1987. But there are accounts in the medical literature which are said to be of children suffering from this condition going back more than 100 years. The first such account was published all the way back in 1902 by George Still, the founding father of pediatric medicine. And of course, he didn't use the term ADHD. His account described 20 children, 15 boys and 5 girls. And one thing is for sure, this was a bunch of seriously disturbed kids who lied, stole, destroyed property, viciously attacked other children and even adults, touched other children sexually, banged their heads, smeared their feces, walked in their sleep, tortured animals, set fire. And another thing that's obvious is that these seriously disturbed kids came from seriously disturbed families, rife with tales of illness, drunkenness, abandonment, insanity. In one of these cases, the boy's father had murdered his mother. Now, Dr. Still gave no consideration whatsoever to the possibility that these children's problems may have had their roots in family dysfunction. Rather, he took all this as proof that these children arose from inferior genetic stock. Now, over the years, there were a number of other accounts by clinicians that are now said to be of the same condition. And one thing is for sure, they've had, if they're all talking about the same condition, they've had a devil of a time agreeing about very much, beginning with what to call it, a lack of moral control, organic drivenness, hyperkinetic impulse disorder, post-encephalitic behavior disorder, minimal brain damage, minimal brain dysfunction, attention deficit disorder, and finally ADHD. And they've also had a devil of a time agreeing among themselves as to what actually constitutes this condition. Often the quote-unquote symptoms of this condition are mutually exclusive. C. Keith Connors was a professor of psychology at Harvard, and he invented a rating scale, which is still used to diagnose this condition. And according to the Connors rating scale, submissive is a symbol of hyperactivity, as is defiant. Excitable is listed, and so is inattentive. Stubborn made the cut, as did overly eager to please. Oh, by the way, toward the end of his life, old Doc Connors felt pretty bad about the monster he helped create. He once called the skyrocketing rates of diagnosis and drugging for ADHD a national disaster of dangerous proportions. Another fellow who did a lot to popularize this diagnostic category was Paul Wender, who was a professor of child psychiatry at the Johns Hopkins Hospital. And he published the first book on the subject for the general reader titled The Hyperactive Child. And like Dr. Connors, he had a long list of often mutually exclusive symptoms. The hyperactive child may be too independent or not independent enough. He may be easily distracted, or he may focus relentlessly on a particular task. Usually, it is an activity they chose themselves, Dr. Wender adds, as if that were a bad thing. The hyperactive child may have problems with intellectual development, or he may not. He may have difficulties in coordination, or he may be well-coordinated and an excellent athlete. He may have difficulty making friends, or he may make friends easily. In fact, according to Dr. Wender, a hyperactive child need not be hyperactive at all. One of the symptoms he lists for hyperactivity is extreme sluggishness. Now, Dr. Wender begins his book with this description of the hyperactive child, which I'd like to read aloud now. The parents frequently report that after an active and restless infancy, the child stood and walked at an early age, and then, like an infant King Kong, burst the bars of his crib and marched forth to destroy the house. Wow. One thing's for sure. This guy hates kids. And in the third iteration of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or the DSM-3, which kicked off the current era of biological psychiatry, the corresponding category was attention deficit disorder, or ADD, and attention deficit disorder with hyperactivity, or ADDH. And in 1987, these two categories were combined into a single one, ADHD. And so this category is diagnosed. There's, as we'll see later, there's no test, no biological test for ADHD or any of the other functional disorders treated by psychiatrists. It's diagnosed by symptom checklists. And if you take a look at these checklists, one thing is perfectly clear. These symptoms are hopelessly subjective and context dependent.
So Patrick, you brought up an interesting point, because what is the difference between ADHD, attention deficit hyperactive disorder, and ADD, attention deficit disorder? What's the difference?
Well, originally it was called hyperactivity or hyperkinetic impulse disorder, something like that. And in the 1970s, they switched from giving the emphasis to hyperactivity to giving equal emphasis to hyperactivity and inattention. And this switch guaranteed that many more children, including many more girls, would receive this label. although this remains a diagnostic category given primarily to boys.
Which brings me to my next question. Do you have any idea what percent of the children and teens diagnosed as ADHD are boys?
It's the great majority of them. I don't have a quote offhand, but certainly the great majority.
So the majority are boys.
Yes.
So Padre Khan, what are the drugs given, prescribed, the medical prescriptions prescribed for ADHD?
Well, the most commonly prescribed drug is amphetamine. Adderall consists of mixed salts of amphetamine. This is the drug commonly known on the street as speed. It's not a similar drug. It's the same drug. The same drug. And the next most commonly prescribed drug is Ritalin, which is the trade name for methylphenidate. And this is a drug that is similar to speed and chemical structure and does more or less the same thing to the body. These are dangerous, highly addictive drugs. Even the DEA says so. Now, the first clinician to prescribe amphetamine for this condition was Charles Bradley, who worked at the Bradley home in Rhode Island back in the 1930s. For the record, the Bradley home was founded by George Bradley, a distant cousin of Charles. But anyway, every history of ADHD mentions Dr. Bradley and his work giving amphetamine to troubled children at the Bradley home. But what is usually glossed over or never mentioned at all is why he started giving this drug to kids in the first place. Now, Dr. Bradley was using a technique called pneumoencephalography to study the brains of his young charges. This is a technique, a now obsolete technique, it's no longer used, but back then a child would be strapped into a rotating chair. And after enduring a painful lumbar puncture, a quantity of spinal fluid would be withdrawn and replaced with a bubble of air. And then the chair would be rotated into a series of positions in a specified sequence in order to allow the air bubble to displace the cerebrospinal fluid in the brain. And to make a better contrast for taking x-rays. And this procedure caused severe headaches, neck stiffness, fever, elevated high heartbeat, high blood pressure, any or all of which could last for days. And it could take weeks for the normal amount of cerebrospinal fluid to be regenerated. Now, Dr. Bradley became concerned about the misery this procedure was inflicting on his young charges. Not concerned enough to stop doing it, but concerned nonetheless. So he tried giving the new drug amphetamine to these boys, and he found it had no effect whatsoever on their headaches. What it did do was flatten their affect, increase their ability to concentrate on boring tasks. In other words, it created in these kids the kind of changes that an exhausted school teacher or an exhausted parent would likely regard as improvements. Oh, and what about Dr. Bradley's pneumoencephalographic studies of the brains of his young charges that caused so much misery to these boys? They produced no findings that were of any use to science whatsoever.
So, Patrick Hahn, in October of the year 2022, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration announced that there is a shortage of Adderall, a shortage of these amphetamine mixed salts used for ADHD people. How is the shortage of Adderall affecting people? Is it causing people to consider more natural ways of dealing with hyperactivity?
Sadly, I haven't seen any indication of that. I've read some articles. Yeah, this is a new development. I've read some articles. They encourage parents to ration out the pills, like don't give them to kids on weekends or cut them in half, to find new sources, to consider other drugs. But I haven't heard any of the quote unquote experts talk about giving up the pills. Sorry to say.
So now the people who take these medications, what are the supposed benefits of Adderall and Ritalin?
Well, as I mentioned, there are hundreds of studies that show that these drugs flatten the affect. They increase the ability to concentrate on boring tasks. As I said, they produce the kinds of changes in kids that an exhausted school teacher or an exhausted parent might regard as improvements. And that is it. There are no data demonstrating any long-term benefits of giving these drugs to kids. And you don't have to take my word for that. In my book, I have quote after quote from eminently credentialed experts writing in the pages of peer-reviewed medical journals. Probably every one of these experts was pro-med, by the way, attesting to this fact. Now, the MTA study was designed to fill this gap in our knowledge. This was far and away the longest, far and away the largest, far and away the longest randomized controlled trial of the effects of stimulant drugs on kids. And these researchers, 600 children were randomly assigned to one of four conditions: medication alone, medication plus therapy, therapy alone, and usual community care. And these researchers, all of whom were pro-med, pulled out all the stops to give the drugs a chance to work. And by the 8-year mark, there was no difference between any of the four treatment groups for any of 24 outcome variables. No effect on ADHD symptoms, no effect on oppositional behavior or antisocial behavior, no effect on anxiety or depression, no effect on reading skills, math skills, grade point averages, grade retention, no effect on social functioning, psychiatric hospitalization, auto accidents, traffic tickets, the list goes on and on. In fact, the only long-term effect these researchers were able to document, the only one, was that these drugs stunted the kids' growth, and they didn't catch up. By the 16-year mark, the drug kids averaged almost 2 inches shorter than the undrugged ones.
Now, with that, let's take a break and listen to a message from one of our commercial sponsors here at UK Health Radio. And we'll be right back with Patrick Kahn, author of Obedience Pills, ADHD, and the Medicalization of Childhood.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Patrick Kahn, author of Obedience Pills, you and I understand that the human brain doesn't finish developing until a person is about 25 or 26 years old. What does the research show about how taking Adderall and Ritalin affects brain development.
Well, that's the thing. If they find a difference in the brains, they're likely to attribute it to the underlying condition rather than the drugs. These drugs cause Adderall, at least amphetamine, causes Parkinson's disease. We know that. So the children who swallow these pills today may be dealing with the effects decades from now.
That's shocking. So, and the scientific research shows that Adderall causes Parkinson's disease?
Yes.
And how long after someone finishes taking, and presumably people don't take Ritalin or Adderall the rest of their lives, how many years does it take for someone who's taken Adderall to then develop Parkinson's disease?
Decades. But yeah, they have the data that show that the kids given these drugs, as they age, they're much more likely to get Parkinson's disease.
Now, in the medical community, people talk about gateway drugs. So, for example, OxyContin, the pain medication, is a gateway drug for the use of heroin. Do Adderall and Ritalin lead to the use of other psychiatric drugs as people age?
Well, these drugs have created a current epidemic of, along with antidepressants, they have created the current epidemic of bipolar disorder in children. This condition was unheard of until we began dosing large numbers of children with stimulants and antidepressants. And it is occurring in precisely the same children who are given these drugs. And so hundreds of thousands of children have been saddled with a crippling, possibly lifelong, potentially fatal condition. This is huge. And the medical profession is perfectly aware this is going on. But they take the bizarre position that these drugs are merely unmasking a pre-existing condition. And in my book, I have example after example of children who were given these drugs and they become manic. And instead of taking them off the drugs, they give them more drugs, stronger drugs, higher doses, until someone who started out with just the normal problems of childhood, or sometimes not even that, ends up a career mental patient. And the drugs given for bipolar disorder include so-called antipsychotic drugs. And those are truly nasty drugs. Now, in the course of researching this book, one name kept coming up again and again. Joseph Biederman of Harvard and Mass General. Biederman is kind of like the Pied Piper of pediatric psychopharmacology. No one has done more to promote the diagnosis and drugging of children for ADHD and its bastard offspring, childhood bipolar disorder, than Joseph Biederman. Thanks largely to him, children as young as 2 years of age are being diagnosed with bipolar disorder and put on powerful, brain-damaging, so-called antipsychotic drugs.
So how exactly do the use of Adderall, Ritalin, and antidepressants lead to bipolar disorder? Is it the combination of the drugs together that changes people's brains?
Well, I mean, these drugs are stimulants. And we don't know exactly what they're doing to the brain, but it's not good. I mean, everybody knows that amphetamine causes mania. I mean, I'm so old I can remember even back when the hippies knew speed kills. And this is, as I said, it's the same drug. It's not even a similar drug. It's the same drug.
So now how does Adderall and the amphetamine mixed salts lead to adrenal burnout or chronic fatigue syndrome as people age?
Oh, I don't know about that, but that sounds like a possibility worth investigating.
Well, it's an important question. So many of my clients have adrenal burnout and are exhausted. So, and when you're constantly taking stimulants to just get through the day, that can lead to adrenal burnout for sure.
Yeah, that makes sense because amphetamine is similar in chemical structure to adrenaline. So everybody who knows anything about life as it is lived knows that if when you take a drug, your body adapts to the presence of that drug. So if you're taking a drug that is similar in chemical structure to adrenaline, seems pretty obvious your body is going to ramp down the production of adrenaline. So what you've said is certainly plausible. I think that sounds definitely like something worth investigating.
Now, so Patrick Hahn, author of Obedience Pills, what are the damaging side effects of Adderall and Ritalin?
Well, by far the most important one is the one I mentioned, the mania and bipolar disorder. And that can lead to an iatrogenic cascade, which someone who started out with the normal problems of childhood can end up with a career mental patient or dead.
And for our audience, iatrogenic disease is, the definition of that is disease caused by your medical doctor. And it's what the subtitle of your book, The Medicalization of Childhood. So what you're saying is taking all these chemical drugs together changes your brain, causes mania. And what are the other common side effects?
Well, I'd say that's far and away the most important one. There's some indication can cause heart problems, even cardiac arrest. That admittedly is a minor effect. But as I said, there's no demonstrated long-term benefits. And the scientific literature is quite clear on that. So I would say anything would be enough to tip the balance to not giving them to kids.
And long-term, you were saying the Adderall is known to cause Parkinson's disease.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
So do ADHD medications cause addiction to other kinds of drugs?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Nadine Lambert was a clinical psychologist at Berkeley, and she carried out a long-term study of almost 500 children in San Francisco and followed them up for 20 years. And in 1998, she published her findings, which showed that the rate of addiction to cocaine, stimulants, and tobacco was higher in the hyperactive kids than in a set of match controls, higher still in the ones who had been given medication, and highest of all in those who had been medicated for a year or more. Now, a year later, Joseph Biederman, the fellow we were just talking about, published his study, which claimed that the rate of drug addiction in medicated kids was 85% lower in the medicated ones. Now, that sounds like an impressive finding, but a couple of points need to be kept in mind. One is that compared to Nadine Lambert's study, the Biederman group study was tiny. They had 56 medicated subjects and 19 unmedicated ones, compared to nearly 500 in Dr. Lambert's study. And of the 19 unmedicated ones, 7 out of the 19 had a substance use disorder at baseline, whereas none of the medicated ones did. But Dr. Lambert subsequently found herself to be a pariah in the research community. The National Institute of Drug Abuse refused to fund her efforts to carry out more studies or to conduct a more thorough analysis of the data she already had. Journals would not publish her replies to her critics. And unfortunately, she never got her career back on track. In 2006, she was killed in a car crash. And 3 years after that, the MTA study, which I was talking about, came out. They found no effect of drugging kids for ADHD on the likelihood of developing a substance use disorder. And a year after that, the Biederman Group published a more extensive study, and like the MTA study, they found no effect one way or another on drugging kids on the likelihood of a substance use disorder. But seems to me that's setting the bar pretty low. Is it the whole point of giving these drugs to kids to make them better? And even these unimpressive results were achieved only after controlling for comorbid conduct disorder, which is a known risk factor for substance use disorder. So what the Biederman Group was saying, in effect, was drugging kids for ADHD does not increase the likelihood of a substance use disorder, provided you don't look at the kids who are most at risk for a substance use disorder. So, to answer your original question, does drugging kids for ADHD increase the likelihood of substance use disorder? Common sense, which deserves deference until the facts prove otherwise, would seem to indicate that plying children with dangerous, highly addictive drugs might increase the likelihood of drug abuse in some of them. Certainly Dr. Lambert's large and extensive study showed it did. And no one has ever debunked her methods or data, even though the ADHD industry would seem to have a huge vested interest in doing so. The strongest evidence to the contrary comes from the Biederman Group, many of whom, like Dr. Biederman, have received massive infusions of cash from the drug makers. And finally, no one who is in a position to do so seems interested in performing the definitive study, and that in and of itself may tell us something.
And with that, let's take a break and listen to a message from one of our commercial sponsors here at UK Health Radio, and we'll be right back. Hang in there with us, and we'll hear more from Patrick Hahn, author of Obedience Pills.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
So Patrick Hahn, author of Obedience Pills and affiliate professor of biology at Loyola University in Maryland. I actually started my career in natural healing, learning about natural healing for the brain. And I found this subject extremely fascinating. One of the things that's fascinating to me is that there's 54 possible brain profiles. So the chances that you and I, our brains work the same is very low. So all of us interpret the world differently. And when you understand brain profiles, then you understand that everyone has a dominant brain hemisphere. So you're either left brain dominant or right brain dominant. And when you are stressed, the non-dominant hemisphere of your brain is 75 to 85% shut down. So if you're right brain dominant and you become stressed, you have difficulty accessing the left side of the brain. Or if you're left brain dominant and you become stressed, you have trouble accessing the right side of the brain. And the opposite side of the brain controls the opposite side of the body. So your right brain hemisphere controls your left eye, your left ear, your left hand, and your left foot. And the left hemisphere controls your right eye, your right ear, your right hand, and right foot. So there's all these different possible permutations of how people's brains work. And when you really study brain profiles, what you realize is that many people, in fact, most people have some challenge either seeing, listening, talking, or moving, or all of the above when we get stressed. So this can be interpreted as ADD, ADHD. And when you get both sides of the brain working better, then you can see even when you're stressed, you can hear even when you're stressed, you can speak even when you're stressed, and you can move even when you're stressed. So that's sort of a short summary. In your professional opinion, as the author of Obedience Pills, is ADHD actually a disease?
Well, depends on how you define a disease. Now, one definition of disease is something that has measurable signs. Now, we already talked about Dr. Bradley's pneumoencephalographic studies of the brains of troubled children, which yielded no findings that were of any value to medical science whatsoever. Now, in 1950, Dr. Bradley left the Bradley home to go on to found the Department of Child Psychiatry at the University of Oregon. But bizarre experiments on the brains of children at the Bradley home continued under the auspices of his successor, Maurice Laufer. Now, around this same time, a distinguished French neurologist, Henri Gastaut, developed a technique in which he would inject subjects with metrazole, which is a drug known to produce convulsions, and then have them stare at strobe lamps until they underwent violent fits. And by titrating the dose of metrazole, he could calculate the precise amount needed to induce these violent fits. Now, my reaction upon reading this is to conclude that injecting human beings with neurotoxins and assaulting their senses with strobe lamps until they have violent fits is not such a great idea, which may explain why I'm not a world-famous neurologist. But that is not the conclusion the distinguished Dr. Gastaut wanted us to draw. He decided this was a test proving something or other about brain function. And anyway, this came to the attention of Dr. Laufer at the Bradley home. He thought this sounded like a great idea. So he tried this out on the children at the home. And again, they found nothing that was of any value to medical science whatsoever.
Well, again, from my work, what you realize is that because everyone's brains work differently, most people have some form of learning challenge, except for maybe the geniuses who can see, hear, talk, and move even when they're stressed. And their challenge is to understand the rest of us. It's like, why are we having trouble? And even I can remember listening to Dr. Daniel Amen, famous author, brain expert. And he, when he looks at thousands of brain scans, there's almost no such thing as a so-called normal brain.
Sure. The brain is such a complex structure, has so many parts. If you take a few dozen people and scan their brains and just divide them in half at random and scan their brains, you'll find something in the one group that's different from the other group. But that's, you're not testing one hypothesis there. You're testing hundreds of hypotheses there. So just by chance, you're bound to find some difference. But that leads me to a good point. We spent zillions of dollars on brain imaging studies of ADHD, and we found no difference, which can reliably and repeatedly has been shown to distinguish the brains of kids with ADHD from the brains of quote-unquote normal children. We spent zillions of dollars on genome-wide association studies of ADHD, and again, they found nothing. There is no abnormality of brain structure that can be used to diagnose ADHD. There is no abnormality of brain function which can be used to diagnose ADHD. There is no gene for ADHD. And how could there be? There are hundreds of reasons why any given child might have problems with inattention or hyperactivity. How could there be a common neural substrate or a common gene behind all these problems? Much better to find out the source of a given child's problems and address that than to attribute the child's problems to some mythical disease entity, the existence of which has never been demonstrated.
So Patrick Hahn, author of Obedience Pills, in your professional opinion, who benefits the most from drugging children?
Well, obviously the drug companies benefit. Right now, we spend $20 billion a year drugging kids for ADHD. For that kind of outlay, we could pay the mid-career salaries of an extra 350,000 teachers or 800,000 teachers' aides. Now, besides the drug companies, we have a whole profession, psychiatry, which is based on the fiction that every variety of human distress is caused by a drug-treatable brain disease. And when doctors graduate from medical school, they have a $200,000 student loan indenture hanging around their necks. And if they choose to specialize in psychiatry, there's no way they're going to pay that off by doing psychotherapy. They are locked into the medical model for life. As Sinclair Lewis said, it's awfully hard to get a man to understand something when his income depends on him not understanding it. And so, go ahead.
So what has happened to the rate of ADHD diagnosis since the pandemic began?
Well, in the course of the school pandemic, schools were shuttered. After-school sports programs were canceled. Zoom meetings were substituted for actual human contact. 3 million children just dropped off the radar. They weren't attending school, not even virtually. Nobody knew what happened to them. And meanwhile, thousands of mommies and daddies have died from overdoses and unintentional injuries that have soared in the wake of the pandemic restrictions. Untold numbers more lost homes, jobs, businesses they've worked all their lives to build. And surprise, surprise, the rate of diagnosis and drugging of kids for ADHD has skyrocketed. And in my book, I quote several eminently credentialed experts who attribute this to all these various stressors. And I'm reading this and I'm thinking, you've just said it. These complaints that fall under the diagnostic label ADHD are not due to some drug-treatable brain disease. They are perfectly understandable reactions to the distressing circumstances a child finds himself in. Wouldn't changing those circumstances be better than drugging the child?
Now, Patrick Hahn, what is the picture like in other nations?
Well, the United States has 4% of the world's population, but we account for 80% of consumption of stimulant drugs for children. But the rest of the world is catching up with us. The situation for the drug makers is kind of like the situation for the tobacco companies. They know they're getting close to market saturation here, but to them, the rest of the world, especially the third world, represents a huge untapped market. And If you read investment newsletters, they note breathlessly how the COVID pandemic has caused, as we just said, caused the rate of diagnosis and drugging of children to skyrocket. And they gush about innovations like fruit-flavored, chewable amphetamine tablets for kiddies. And it's obvious that they regard children's bodies and brains as nothing more than new territory for them to colonize. So there's no doubt the rate of diagnosis and drugging for this condition will continue to skyrocket the world over.
So Patrick Khan, where do we go from here?
Well, the last time I was here, you asked me that question and I talked in generalities. This time I'm going to talk in specifics. First, we need to stop drugging children for behavioral problems. Just stop it. Stop all of it. They've been giving these drugs to children for 85 years, and there are still no data demonstrating any long-term benefits. It's time we said to the drug makers, your time is up. We're moving on. We're going to look for other solutions. In the course of researching my book, I talked to Deborah Rhea, who's a professor of physical education at Texas Christian University. And they invented what they called the LINK program. And kids' grades, kindergarten through third grade, were given an hour of unstructured outdoor free play time every day. And this was done without lengthening the school day. And they found the incidence of off-task behaviors in the classroom went down, as did the incidence of disruptive, self-injurious, and antisocial behaviors. And listening comprehension increased, as did the incidence of positive behaviors on the playground: smiling, laughing, jumping, clapping, hopping, skipping, cheering. Imagine that. Kids who are allowed to play outside laugh and smile more. Now, what about those all-important standardized test scores? They went up. Didn't go up by a lot, but they went up. They didn't go down. More outdoor free playtime, happier, healthier kids, and higher test scores sounds to me like a win-win-win. So the main thing is to do something. The task of childhood is to learn to manage difficult emotions. And the task of parents, and always remember teachers are in loco parentis, is to help them with that. And pretending children's difficulties stem from a drug-treatable brain disease is a preposterous distraction from doing that.
So Patrick Khan, author of Obedience Pills, any final thoughts for our audience?
Well, the main thing is to do something, and to parents to remember, you have more power than you think. You have tremendous power to help your child. There's nothing in the life of a child that is more important than the quality of that child's relationship with his parents.
You've been listening to The Natural Healing Show for UK Health Radio. I'm your host, Catherine Kerrigan, medical intuitive healer, Amazon number one bestselling author. You can find out more about me and my work at CatherineKerrigan.com and UnlimitedEnergyNow.com. While you're there, definitely sign up for my newsletter so you can learn even more about how you can heal yourself naturally. Our guest today has been Patrick Khan, affiliate professor of biology at Loyola University and author of three books, including Obedience Pills, ADHD, and the Medicalization of Childhood. And Patrick Khan, I'll let you pronounce your website for our audience again.
Okay, it's Meliponula, Meliponula, meliponula.wordpress.com.
Thanks so much for listening. And remember, natural healing works, and there's myriad ways you can heal your brain naturally. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Natural Healing Show. Keep it natural with the Natural Healing Show.